IndieCast is presented by Uproxx's Indie Mixtape.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to IndieCast. On this show, we talk about the biggest indie news of the week, we review albums, and we hash out trends. In this episode, we talk about the possible downfall of Coachella and our early contenders for Album of the Year. My name is Stephen Hayden, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host. He apologizes for the diss track directed at NPR's All Songs Considered, Ian Cohen. Ian, how are you?
Yeah, if you go to the Patreon that we're cooking up here for IndieCast, there's just like 12 minutes of diss tracks about like Bob Boylan's hats. You know, we go in on this guy.
Is he still there? I think he retired.
You know, yeah, actually he did retire. He retired in October. He's not doing shows, but fell off like the Simpsons. That's an actual J. Cole line. As a matter of fact, we're going to talk about the J. Cole song that has like Stone Temple Pilots and Simpsons references. I think you might like it.
What's the STP reference?
Something about like throwing rocks at your head or something like that.
Huh. Okay.
That one didn't quite hit.
We didn't actually diss All Songs Considered. Yeah, maybe we should, though. Maybe we should be having some podcast beefs. You know, like, let's go after, like, Rob Harvella. 60 Songs Explain the 90s. Actually, that show is, I think, stopped. So we're too late for Rob.
He just retired before we could get into beef with him. I mean, that's just what happens. Bob Boylan, Rob Harvella, they don't want that smoke with IndieCast.
That's true. But we like Rob. We know Rob. We're not going to diss Rob. Or if it would be like a wrestling type situation where we're all in on it. I can't see Rob, though, dissing us. He seems too nice for that.
Yeah.
So that probably wouldn't work. Anyway, we're talking about diss tracks because, as you may have heard, there was some controversy this week. J. Cole put out his new record, and he included a diss track on the record called 7-Minute Drill, directed at Kendrick Lamar. And I believe that this was in retaliation for Kendrick talking about J. Cole on a Future song. Am I correct?
Yeah, there was a Future Metro Boomin album that had like a Kendrick track on there. And like all anyone remembers from that album for the most part is like, you know, Kendrick, you know, throwing shots at the song One Person Shooter, which is Drake and J. Cole. So this concept that like these three are like the big three in hip hop, at least amongst like, you know, washed 30 something year old dudes who also really like MF Doom a lot and talk about like real hip hop, son. It's interesting because it's like a little exasperating at this point. But yeah, he had to fire back in the very J. Cole fashion.
Yeah, and he includes this diss track on his record that dropped last week. And then I think the next day, the day after the album dropped, he was performing a concert and he apologized for the diss track. Like a very quick about face. And I'm trying to think, has this ever happened before? Where someone puts out a diss track and then they immediately apologize? Is this unprecedented in the history of diss tracks?
This has actually happened before. I can think of Jay-Z's Super Ugly. This came out after Nas did Ether in response to Takeover. And like, you know, Super Ugly, it's, you know, as the title describes, it's like a really nasty song. Mostly talking about like, you know, the mother of like Nas's child. And actually like Jay-Z's mom encouraged him to apologize, and Jay-Z did that, I believe, on the radio. That's definitely happened before. But this, you know, I think this was interesting because, like, he did it at, like, a concert, it appears, and he also called it, he didn't just say, like, oh, I stepped over the line in the same way that, like, Jay-Z did. He literally called this the lamest shit I've done in my life, which, you know, this is J. Cole we're talking about. He made, like, entire songs about, like, in his mind, disappointing Nas. So yeah, this carries considerable weight, but it was also like not really considered an effective diss track to begin with. So it's just like J. Cole doing extremely J. Cole things in a way that reinforces the, you know, perceptions people like myself have of him, that he's just like this corny ass dude. So,
well, didn't he make like a crack about Kendrick having like a trans relative and making fun of his? I don't know. I can't remember if it's his uncle or aunt. Wasn't that an element of it? It was something, because I just saw people. I didn't delve too deep into this story, but I saw people talking about the transphobic element of the diss track.
Yeah, I missed that because, you know, Kendrick does have like a song, did have a song on his last album where he, you know, some would say like kind of clumsily handled reckoning with having, you know, like an uncle or something along those lines who was like trans or, you know, experiencing like gender dysphoria, some along those lines. But yeah, I think it was just like, it was very clear, and it always has been, like J. Cole loves Kendrick Lamar way too much to start dissing him. And I think what people really cottoned on to was there's a part where J. Cole like breaks down his opinions on you know, Kendrick Lamar's albums, and he suggests that like To Pimp a Butterfly was overrated, which did lead to like a little bit of a flare up in the Twitter community of like people who have been just waiting since 2015 to say, yeah, man, it's actually really fucking boring, man. And I actually listened to Pimp a Butterfly this past week for the first time. Wow. You certainly can't call it boring. There are a couple of songs where he gets it over his skis. Like, I still think the song about like a homeless man being God is a bit like silly in a kind of a late 90s way. But, yeah, I think that this was disappointing to me, because otherwise this week we have just seen so much unrepentant peer-on-peer hater shit.
Oh, yeah.
That like
the haterism, like, is back.
Oh, it like peer-to-peer, too. It's not like, you know, someone punching down or punching up, which, you know, can feel like enjoyable and like short bursts. But this is like other writers going at other writers in a way which, like, has gotten things like Book Forum and the BAFTA like trending on Twitter.
Well, there was the big thing this week. This was a viral review of an essay collection by the New York writer Lauren Euler.
It's actually based out of Berlin now. That's like a big part
of in Berlin. Oh, that's right. But
that's a big part of her persona, yeah.
Doesn't she split time between Berlin and New York? I mean, I'm already laughing at I don't know her at all. I don't really I've read. See, she became famous because she wrote very vicious reviews of other people's books.
Yes.
That was her claim to fame. And then she became an author. She wrote a novel, and now she has this essay collection. And there was a review in Book Forum that was brutal. And I have to say, again, I don't know this writer at all. I haven't really read her stuff. My instinct is to feel bad for her because, you know, as an author myself, I put myself in that position of just being destroyed in a review. Like, the thing about that review that is so devastating is that the reviewer looked up references that she made in terms of her research. Like, she was researching various topics for these essays, and she discovered that in many instances she just used the top result on the Google search for that particular topic. Or she just like took something from Wikipedia, like not copying it, but clearly just relying on Wikipedia for research. And she has like this paragraph where it's like, I don't know how many instances of this, like just several instances. And that's the kind of thing that it's a good lesson for writers. Like, don't be lazy with your research, because there is one crazy person out there who might track your Google searches and realize that you're just being super lax with your research. So that was pretty devastating. That I mean, that is like the, you know, that's the takeover of literary disses, man. Like, that's Jay-Z going after Nas back in 2001 level viciousness. With that, I don't know. I'm of two minds of this J. Cole thing. On one hand, it is lame to do a diss track, put it on your record, and then immediately backtrack from it when the public doesn't really support what you did.
I mean, he called the mixtape Might Delete Later, so maybe this right. was like the plan all along. But
yeah, but like, just don't put it out then. I don't know. That's such a... That's so weak. But on the other hand, you know, in this age of social media, like, where we're all posting way too much. And you post things sometimes off the dome, and then you immediately feel bad about it. Who among us has not deleted a catty tweet or a catty post? I had something this week, and I guess it defeats the purpose of deleting it if I'm going to mention it, but there is a band called Still Houseplants. Guess what kind of band Still Houseplants is? If I just told you there's a band called Still Houseplants, what would you guess is their genre?
Well, I've heard of this band, but like I would suggest that that sounds like kind of Rye, maybe Angular, probably from the UK.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's British post-punk.
Okay.
That's what they are. And I made a catty tweet about how we have to stop this trend of British post-punk bands named after extremely mundane things. Because that's the trend right now. Like, we're on the verge of seeing, like, a band called Toothpaste Dispenser. Or, you know, Garbage Disposal Motor. You know, like, these are going to... There probably is a band called Garbage Disposal Motor right now. And they're probably... You know, there's probably a singer that just talks over, like you said, very angular guitar. Maybe, like, an overactive rhythm section. But anyway, I did that tweet and then I felt bad about it, so I deleted it. And, you know, that's my version of J. Cole, I guess, going after Kendrick.
Yeah, I can relate. I mean, I'm actually interested what you think about their actual music. I mean, to me, it just sounds like Dirty Projectors if they didn't have, like, songs. But I know that's, like, something that a lot of people are super into. But yeah, like that, like, J. Cole doing that, like, one of the most relatable things. And I think that's, like, kind of like J. Cole's appeal, that he seems like a star, but also kind of an everyman. There have been so many times where I've like let a tweet, like a negative one, not even about a popular band, but like just about one that might even be at like Still Houseplants levels. I'll like let it sit for like 5 seconds because I'm like, I shouldn't put this out into the world. You know, it might get a few laughs, and then there's that like second wave of people who might, you know, make my life on Twitter miserable for a couple hours. Like, I just don't need that energy. But on the other hand, this is such a good tweet. I got to get this out. And, like, I'll put it up for 5 seconds and delete it and, like, hope no one screenshotted it. So, Jay, I think you lost the battle, but maybe won the war going forward.
Yeah, it's not a cool move, but it also makes me feel like, maybe I could hang out with J. Cole. Maybe he'd be a nice guy to hang out with. Let's talk about Coachella. Coachella, starting this week, first of two weekends. And if you don't remember, and you probably don't, but the headliners this year are Lana Del Rey, Tyler, the Creator, and Doja Cat. Those are the three big names. A little bit further down, you've got Blur on there. you got No Doubt. There's Sublime. I don't know which version of Sublime, but they're going to be there. Peso Puma, Jay Blavin. Got Kerrang! Been
Jay
in there.
Jay Balvin.
What did I say?
You called him Jay Blavin.
I had that for something else where I transposed the L and some other letter. I've got some sort of issue with that. Got Kerrang! Been in there. We're going to be talking about Kerrang! Been a little bit later in this episode. They have a new album out today as well. It's interesting because, you know, we're used to Coachella just being like a slam dunk. Every year, they announce the lineup, or even before they announce the lineup. It just seems like an instant sellout every year. But that's not the case in 2024. The first weekend is sold out, but the second weekend, there's still tickets available. And there's an article in the Los Angeles Times that was published this week where they ask in the headline, has Coachella lost its shine? And it's because of this... sales slump, if you want to call that. I think it's also related to the lineup. The lineup seems a little blah this year. And also, the cost of going to Coachella, which I didn't realize it was this much, general admission tickets are $549. And that's before you pay for anything else there. Like, just to get in the door. $549. And if you're going for VIP, it's like over $1,200. And this is in an environment where ticket prices across the board are very expensive. You got big tours going on everywhere. And like live music generally is doing really well right now. It's a booming part of the music industry. But in the LA Times story, it talks about how like Lana Del Rey had a recent tour that I think ended at the end of 2023. Tyler, the Creator, played in Southern California, I think fairly recently. So there may not be a lot of urgency even to see the biggest acts here. What say you, Ian? You've been to Coachella. I've never been to Coachella. I will probably never go to Coachella at this point. Do you think it's lost its shine?
You know, like this morning, you threw me a little bit for a loop when you said that we were going to be discussing Coachella. And for the very reason that you mentioned, which is that since they announced the lineup, I haven't thought about it like once. I don't think that's an exaggeration until it's
like, no one has talked about it really. No. We initially didn't have it on our in our outline because I'd forgotten that it was happening. And then this morning I remembered, oh yeah, Coachella starts this weekend. We were gonna do a sports cast in this spot, talking about Caitlin Clark and South Carolina women's basketball and how it just owned men's basketball, college basketball this year. Like it got, I think the final game had like 4 million more viewers than the men's game did. And the men's game was super boring. Did you watch it?
Men's on this podcast, I've been like a loud advocate for college football over the pros, but every single thing that makes college like football superior to the NFL, like none of that applies to college basketball. Like the men's game is just like the first half is each team going like 2 for 25 from 3-point. And then yeah, the game gets close by the end, but the last 3 minutes last an hour because of all the timeouts and fouls. It's just like...
Well, they're playing like in a stadium too, which always screws with the game. It's horrible. Meanwhile, you have the women's game. Of course, Caitlin Clark, huge star. She's easily the most famous college basketball player in the world right now. Mm-hmm. South Carolina had like, I don't know how many freshmen coming off the bench that were just nailing threes. I mean, South Carolina just seems unbelievable.
Machine, yeah, they're like it. This is like the NBA.
How are they ever going to lose? that team, like, and the who's the huge center that they have? I can't remember her name.
Yeah, I can't remember. But you know, like the women's tournament this year, you had like teams that like actively hated each other because the rivalries have simmered over a couple of years. You have like really like super villain Bobby Knight type coaches. You got like runner Kim and gunner Mulkey type. Yeah.
That's and like she's like a Righteous Gemstones character.
Yeah, this is like the NBA from the 80s. That's what like the women's game was giving us this year. And like I'm all there for it. It was such a superior product in all ways to the men's game. Where like the best player, like the two-time player of the year, is a guy who's like 7'4" and might be unusable for long stretches of time in the NBA.
And like he's good. We're talking about Zach Edey, but like he's not fun to watch.
No, I don't know.
He's like one of those awkward tall people. I don't know. It's not fun really to see him play. I love how we planned not to do sports cast. We took it out. Yeah. But we actually put it back in because we don't want to talk about Coachella.
I can give my opinion on it as like someone who...
I mean, it has lost its shine. Like
Totally.
To answer the question from the LA Times, yes, it definitely has. I guess the next question is this a temporary thing or is this the beginning of their decline? And that I'm not quite sure about. I do feel like if they just had maybe better headliners... You know, like if they get, I don't know who next year, if they get Beyonce to come back or something, I'm sure they would do huge numbers. But I don't know, maybe not. Maybe, you know, because they have been dominant for a long time. And history shows us that that kind of dominance doesn't last forever.
No, like Coachella has been able to adjust. I'm thinking about, you know, my own experience going there in 2009. Like that was the first time where... there were a lot of articles suggesting like maybe Coachella is like on a inescapable downward decline because like the headliners were Paul McCartney, Killers, and The Cure. Now, mind you, like that sounds awesome to us, but like in 2008-09, like this is what Day and Age era The Killers and The Cure had just released 4:13 Dream, which was, you know, like not a great record. But the next year, I think that was the year they got like Jay-Z and Kanye to play. So they dipped into hip hop the next year and then they went to pop and then they did the two weekends. And that kind of saved things. And, you know, like nowadays, I think you're right in that like a Taylor Swift or Beyonce is about the only thing that could really perhaps reverse the decline, because they've embraced rap, they've embraced pop, they've included more non-English speaking acts. And so, I mean, on one level, like if Coachella completely goes away, do I give a shit? No. Do I care in the sense that like this is one of the only opportunities for like a band such as like Military Gun or Mannequin Pussy to get like a really cool payday by playing at like 2 p.m. to, you know, to like a nobody tent. But yeah, I think that they're either going to like have to go back to the drawing board, or I don't know, let's go back to like the old school, like 1998 roots where they're like, the headliners are like electronic acts, but you also get like Bjork or like, you know, Blur again playing, you know?
Yeah, it would be funny for Coachella to do like a throwback lineup to like what they would have had in 99. So you've got like Beck, you have Jurassic 5, you know, like that kind of stuff as the headliners, just to... maybe that can be like the old timers version of
Coachella. Yeah, my wife would love that.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to give prescriptions on how Coachella could improve because I'm so out of the demographic for what this festival is directed at. I mean, I'm not interested in music festivals in general. I mean, it's just not a great experience once you get a little bit older and your knees get a little weaker. You don't really want to stand in a field for 8 hours at a time. I will say though that there's nothing unique about Coachella anymore, like outside of the setting. It's really about being in the desert, but musically speaking, they're like every other festival. And that is a problem that's like endemic to all of the big time festivals, whether it's Bonnaroo or Lollapalooza or Coachella. They're all interchangeable. The same acts play all the festivals. The idea that like at the beginning, Coachella was this basically alternative music festival, and then Bonnaroo was like the jam band festival, and then Lollapalooza, I mean, they have like alt rock roots, but it was like in the 90s it was about combining different genres. So you'd have like, you know, you'd have Jane's Addiction, and then you'd have like Cypress Hill and
a guy getting like the Monks, and like a guy should, I was about to say a guy getting shot with bile. A cannon, but like I'm like getting it confused with the Simpsons episode.
There's just nothing unique about these festivals really anymore. And I don't know if that's the solution, that you try to build a brand again that is tied to a specific kind of music. Like maybe Coachella, they just lean hard into becoming like electronic music or something, or I don't know, something along those lines. Who knows? Again, I feel like if they book a really big act next year, I said Beyonce, I don't think Beyonce would do it. I mean, maybe she would do it because of her history there. But like, yeah. Taylor Swift, I don't see her ever doing Coachella. I mean, why would she? When you can like do like what, 6 nights at SoFi Stadium, you're not going to do Coachella.
I'm guessing like Billie Eilish probably headlines. She announced a new album.
Like Olivia Rodrigo is on tour right now. She could have headlined, but she's doing her own tour. You know, I just feel like there's so much money in touring. I just wonder like if a lot of these big acts are not interested in doing festivals, like, because if you can just play arenas and charge $200 a ticket, it just makes more sense than to be, you know, no matter how much money they're going to give you. Because like, how much money could you give Taylor Swift, you know, to do something like this? She's already making like $10 million a show, you know, like you can give her like $100 million, you know, it'd have to be something like that. Let's do a fantasy draft update. This is a big day for our fantasy draft. There were, what, 3 albums between the two of us that came out today. Let's see, 2 for you and 1 for me. And it's interesting here because I know, we'll do me first. Maggie Rogers, her album Don't Forget Me is out today. And I remember when we did the draft, this was one that felt like a reach. And I think you were skeptical of this pick as well. I didn't feel great about this pick. I think I went 3rd or 4th with Maggie Rogers. Maggie Rogers, again, this has been a theme so far in our draft. The albums that we thought would maybe just do okay have done really well.
And it's also maybe a bit of the opposite as well. Mackie Rogers, 87 right now on Metacritic. Coming up big.
Yeah.
For me. She only has 4 reviews, so that could go down. I'm a little worried about that, but I feel like she's going to probably do a mid-80s at least, which is exactly what I need from her. So feel, Maggie, I'm sorry I doubted you. You came through big time for me.
Yeah, I think that was a savvy pick. Yeah, she had the New Yorker profile, and I think there's like a little bit of like a makeup call, like what happens with not like pop, like major pop artists, but ones of her ilk where you stick around for like a third album. It's like, okay, we're going to take you seriously now.
Right.
And this is true because most of the reviews say it's like, sounds like Jewel and Sheryl Crow. It's like, it's more just like kind of a review of the person, or maybe it's a great record and I'm just like not particularly interested in it. But that's proving to be quite a savvy pick by you. I was
banking on the makeup call. Because it just seemed like there's a lot of goodwill toward her. And it seemed like if she just makes a good record, people are going to want to call it a great record. And it seems like that's what's happening with Maggie. So, Maggie, I love you. Thank you. You're coming through big for me. We also have Shabaka, your jazz pick. We had conflicting jazz picks in our draft. I went with Kamasi Washington. You went with Shabaka Hutchings. Is it Hutchins or Hutchings? It's Hutchings.
Hutchings with a G.
Yes.
The G is not silent.
His album, Perceive Its Beauty, Acknowledge Its Grace.
Great title.
Doesn't that just sound like an album title critics are going to go for? You know, you're guaranteed at least an 8 if you title your album that. He's coming through with an 84, which is a good score. Is that a little underperforming, though?
Yeah, just as we're recording it, the Pitchfork review ran with an 8.0, and it's doing good. The reviews appear to be polite, but not as effusive as I was hoping for. So, you know, I'm feeling like this is a little bit of an underperformance by our boy.
You know, I was just thinking with the Hutchins versus Hutchings thing, this is like the opposite of what I did with Honking on Bobo. Remember when I said honking on Bobo? And it's like, no, there's no G there.
I'm not going to lie. I don't remember that, but I'm glad that you do.
No,
I said our honking lore.
Well, it was also because I had a cold. So I was a little stuffy. So I think I might have said honking, but it sounded like honking. But you corrected me on that. But now we have the opposite with Hutchins versus Hutchings with Shabaka. And then you have the Nia Archives record out today. Silence is Golden. That's coming through with an 80. That seems a little low.
I saw like an actual yellow colored review on Metacritic, which is like never a good sign. This one, I think this might be like one of those, mid first round NBA picks where like the person they draft like is in the G League the whole, and like, oh, what happened to that guy? Yeah. This one might be kind of a dud. I thought it was funny because you mentioned all these like British talky post-punk bands with very mundane names. And right now there's one called English Teacher that is like rocking a 96 after 8 reviews. So
English Teacher.
Yeah. English Teacher. Now
that's such a British
the
band,
fucking man. Record is great. I'll probably end up listening to it. Cause what the fuck else better do I have to do? But yeah, 96.
I had this attitude towards dry cleaning for a long time and I ended up really liking them. So, but yeah, English Teacher, god damn.
Yeah, they're on Island Universal. Like maybe this is like where I start to like this style of music once it becomes like overtly sellout and major label. We shall see. I'm excited.
Yeah. And then you have Vampire Weekend, which actually went up 1 point. I think it was 88 last week. It's now 89.
Career high by a large distance.
Just killing it. And that was another album that you and I were like, we think critics will like this, but they won't love it. Like I would have predicted an 80 for Vampire Weekend. And they're almost 10 points higher than that. Just an incredible performance by Vampire Weekend on Metacritic. So you have 3 albums out now. Shabaka Hutchings, Nia Archives, Vampire Weekend, all in the 80s. Nia Archives... hopefully that doesn't slip into the 70s. If you slip into the 70s, you're in real trouble.
Yeah,
in the draft.
We're doing slow pulp numbers.
Exactly. And God, we keep picking on slow pulp. which really good band, but yeah, I drafted them and they slipped into the 70s and it killed me in the first
Jamarcus
draft.
Russell of the IndyCast draft.
Well, we won't say Jamarcus Buck. Let's say Marcus Mariota. Marcus okay. Mariota, who, you know, overdrafted. I think he was the second pick, something like that.
Yeah.
And he's not good enough to be the second pick, but, you know, he's still in the pros. He's a good backup. So he's a good professional quarterback. He just was overdrafted. So I would say that was true of Slow Pulp in the draft. Like, they're a good band. Just maybe I overdrafted them. Let's talk about early album of the year contenders. We're through one quarter already in the year. And we're not going to do the thing that some people have done. I've seen people already starting to rank their albums of the year.
Yeah, fuck that.
We've already turned like the mid-year list into an event. You know, like that's a content generator now, like your mid-year list. And like, look, I'm not hating on it. I do a mid-year list. Does good numbers whenever I do it. All love to people doing mid-year lists. But I think if you're doing the quarterly list, it's a little egregious. So we're not actually going to rank here, but we just want to talk about maybe albums that we're really liking or that we think will do well on lists generally. And this is inspired by an album. I think this was last week you talked about it, the new record by Cindy Lee, Diamond Jubilee. And I've been super into this record lately. And for those who don't remember, this is a new project by one of the members of Women. Is it Patrick?
Yeah, Patrick Flagel.
And it's a 32-song album. It's only available on YouTube and on this GeoCities site that is so shady-looking that I tried to post it on Twitter, and Twitter would not let me post it.
Shadow banning, Substack, you know?
They're just like, you know, but it wasn't like a shadow banning thing. It was just like, we don't trust this link, so you can't post it. But I love the record. And the way I described it is, this is like an indie band, like from like maybe like the late 80s, early 90s, that if they put out a greatest hits record, you know, like this indie band that doesn't actually exist from like 30 or 40 years ago. Like, that's what this record sounds like. Like a band that kind of, like, they kind of remind me a little of like bands like Stereolab, Broadcast, those cool, you know, sort of European groups that have like a mastery of like retro music styles, like girl group pop, psych rock, you know, like kraut rock, like that kind of stuff, electronic pop. All that together, and just like a mastery of those different styles. And it reminds me also in a way of that DJ Sabrina, the Teenage DJ record, like not musically, but just in the form of like a really long album. That's like a lot of fun. That just seems to, again, draw from so many different styles of pop music. How are you feeling about this record? I know you recommended it, obviously, last week. Would you count it as, like, one of the year's best so far?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I was kind of joking on the last episode about how this was, like, kind of the sort of album that would be all the rage amongst music writer Twitter in, like, 2010 or 11, because it does kind of hit on that style of, for lack of a better term, hauntological pop. But I think it, like, might actually happen. Like, people are super into it, and I do think the DJ Sabrina, the Teenage DJ comparison's great. I didn't think of that one, but it is kind of the same sort of experience in that, you know, when I'm listening to it and I'm immersed in this 2 hours, and very consistent, it's like, oh, this is fucking amazing. And then it's like something I might listen to one or two more times this year, because it is like a real, like, it is a journey, and it's, you know, it's an obligation, not an obligation, but like you have to kind of just be all in. I find it difficult to go bit by bit. As far as like how it compares to like, you know, other women projects like Public Strain or the Viet Cong, you know, now called Preoccupations, I put those above them because they're, you know, I think they do something a little more original. But yeah, I think this record's going to be, I just think people were so hungry for an old school, like, music critic experience, that the right place, right time. And I think this
just the way it's released, I think, yes, is a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
That it feels a little like a secret that you've been let in on. You know, like the music I think is really great, but just the way it's presented is really intriguing. And Cindy Lee itself as a project, there's a lot of mystery around it. Apparently the tour that I think it's already started.
Yeah. Might like be the seeing last... them next Friday. They're playing San Diego of all fucking places. So
yeah, it's like, and according to the GeoCities site, this is like they're like the last Cindy Lee tour, I guess. But like I've watched live clips on YouTube and it's like a very theatrical live show. It looks very intriguing. Almost like a Blue Velvet type vibe, you know, like when Dean Stockwell is lip syncing Roy Orbison. Like it reminds me of that. Like that just sort of spooky, retro, very cool kind of theatrical presentation. So, man, I checked the tour. It's not coming to Minneapolis. You should definitely go see it in San Diego. I want to hear what that's like to see in person. I bet it would be a great experience. So, yeah, I would say that the Cindy Lee record, definitely one of my favorites of the year. And I know I said a few minutes ago that I'm not going to rank albums yet, but if I have a top five, and I'm not ranking them, I'm just saying these are five albums I like a lot so far this year. I would say Cindy Lee's up there. I would say the Liquid Mike record is up there, that band from the UP. Very fun band, very fun record. Got to put Vampire Weekend up there. I think that record's really good. Love Rosalie, Bite Down. That's in my, you know, among my favorites, my five favorites, my five unranked favorites. Mm-hmm. And then I'll go with Waxahachie. That's the chalk pick. But I think it's a really good record. So those are the ones that I have in mind just for my personal consideration. I would say like in a broader sense, Waxahachie and Vampire Weekend seem like they're going to do well. I don't know. What else is there for you, either personally or more broadly speaking?
Yeah, I mean, the Glass Beach album, that's going to be like probably beginning to end one of my favorites, if not the favorite. I think
it's you've said that from the beginning. So is there anything close to Glass Beach, or is that just like far and away your number one so far?
I feel like I've been engaging in music kind of more on a singles sort of level this year. I think that maybe, you know, the Cindy Lee album is certainly going to be up there. I like the Vampire Weekend album a lot. That's, you know, obviously a contender. I mean, I think the Mannequin Pussy album is going to be one that you see. Like, we definitely have a top 10 starter pack going, you know, between that and Waxahachie and Vampire Weekend and Beyonce. Like, I'm starting to see 2024 as a whole take shape. But, you know, I think just to skip ahead, I mean, the Howdy record's going to be up there, Bedbug. They're albums I like, but, you know, there's nothing that's really... Oh, Little Kid. Most of the albums that, like, I really, really like are ones that have, like, barely been reviewed, despite not being all that off the beaten path. And so it kind of dampens, I guess, the enthusiasm for it, but... Yeah, there's stuff I like a lot. It's just like weird to kind of go and say, yeah, man, like Bedbug, this is my number three album of the year. And like most people don't know what the fuck I'm talking about.
Yeah, but that's what we're here. We're saying it. So yes. It doesn't matter what anyone else is saying. It matters if we're saying it. You know, we are the arbiters here.
It's nice to be the only indie podcast, you know?
Exactly. Who cares about the rest of the world? It's only about what we think. The Beyonce record is interesting because when that came out, immediately people were talking about not only it being the album of the year, but like this is going to be the album that wins the Grammy for album of the year. Like
probably
that
will. Just,
but don't you feel like there's been like a little bit of a fading with that album? I feel like it came out and, you know, people immediately reviewed it, which is strange for an album that's like 3 hours long. I mean, like that album, you talk about Cindy Lee being long. It's not much longer than the Beyonce record. It's about a half hour longer. Which I guess that's not insignificant, but
that's
like
two Joyce Manor albums longer.
Right. But I'm just saying, you know, that album is a marathon, that Beyonce record. And I do get the sense that once people sat with that record a little bit longer, that it lost some of its shine. If I can bring back the cliche here, this is going to be the Lost Its Shine episode where we just talk about things either having its shine or losing its shine. But I don't know. I feel like that record, I'm curious how people are going to feel about it in 6 months. I feel like Renaissance had legs. I don't know about this album.
Yeah.
We'll see, though.
I said, like, oh, yeah, it's definitely going to win all the Grammys. But, like, you know, Billie Eilish just announced an album this week, and God knows how much award shows love her, so.
I mean, Beyonce is definitely due for, like, a makeup call Grammy album of the year. I mean, it is insane that she has not won. She's won more Grammys than anyone else in history, but she hasn't won album of the year. Like, how is that not fishy? It's very strange. And I say that as someone who doesn't really care about who wins album of the year, but, you know, just as a person who looks at the situation, it's very odd that she has not won that award. Let's get to our mailbag. Thank you all for writing in. It's always great to hear from our listeners. You can hit us up at indycastmailbag@gmail.com. Ian, you want to read our first letter?
All right. Hello, Ian / Steve. Guess going alphabetical order. Krangbin, yay or nay. My wife loves them and we're going to see them next month. I'm sure vibes will be vibing. I'm lukewarm. Best, Drew in Cleveland.
Drew in Cleveland. Are you going to go see Krangbin in Cleveland? That seems like an incredible combination. Krangbin, yes. In Cleveland. Yay or nay? I'm going to say yay. Not a strong yay, but I'm going to say yay. This is a band that I saw play live probably, God, what, 4 or 5 years ago? I think it was pre-pandemic. And they were playing in a club that was, it was probably like 250 people there. And I really liked the show. I had a good time. They're a very interesting band to look at as well as to listen to. Maybe more interesting to look at in some ways. You know, the guitar player is wearing this wig and he's playing like bluesy guitar. The bass player is like this beautiful woman who's like very charismatic and she's playing the bass, looking amazing. And then the drummer is like this big dude and he's laying it down in a very mellow way, but he's got a cool look about them. They definitely have an aesthetic that's very definable, which is more than like 99% of bands can say. When I saw them play in that club, I didn't imagine that they would become this huge festival band. They seemed like a band that would be playing festivals at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And honestly, that's an amazing time to see them. I think like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Krangbin would kill that slot. But now they're playing, you know, at night. I think they're headlining some festivals, like at least smaller festivals. Speaking of Coachella, they're at Coachella. They're like on the second line of the poster. I think they're like maybe 3 or 4 acts in. So they're like one of the big bands on the day that they're playing. I think the problem that people have with this band is that they don't seem like they justify their popularity, you know, because there's not a whole lot to them. You know, their music isn't terribly deep. I think it is very appealing on a superficial level, but if you're looking for music to, say, give you a cathartic emotional experience, you're not going to get it from this band. I will say, however, that I think you and your wife, Drew, in Cleveland, will have a very good time at the show, because I think they are a good live band. They're like sort of like a basic jam band. They jam a little bit, but it's like very, it's like baby food jam band, you know, very palatable. Very easy. And, you know, put your arm around your wife, smooch it up a little bit, groove to the music. It'll be a good, you know, have some cocktails. It'll be a good night. So, yeah, I'm going to say a mild yay from me.
I'm going to, like, divert from the Krangbin yay or nay discussion and ask if, like, Drew's a wife guy or a not wife guy with this question. Because, you know, he's putting his feelings aside on this band he's lukewarm over and going to the concert with his wife. So that is like wife guy, but he's also kind of airing her out, her music taste out in this mailbag. So
look, we would all do that though. Yeah, you know, totally. We're all wife guys.
Yeah, totally.
If you're not a wife guy in this respect, like you're not going to go to a show that your wife likes, just get divorced.
Yeah.
Just live by yourself in a trailer. If you're not willing to do that, because you're a jerk, you know, you gotta do that. You gotta go to the show that the wife likes.
Absolutely. I won't say who I went to recently for that, but
Who was it? You gotta say.
Back in the day, I definitely went to see a Sylvan Esso show.
I like Sylvan Esso.
They're fine.
They're good.
But yeah, as far as like Krangbin goes, like, I'm going to probably lose all but 5 people with this reference I'm going to make. But you know, if you were a CD buyer back in like 2000, 2001, you might remember some of these like Luwaka Bop compilations, like Saturday Night Fish Fry and Afro Peruvian Classics, where this label would compile, they'd make compilations of these genres that were really tough to come by back then, you know? Like, no one was buying like a Shuggie Otis or Os Mutantes album, but you would get them and, you know, you would put them on at a party and it would sound like super exotic and urbane, and it would be like, oh yeah, these people have good taste. It's music that like radiates good taste. And then we would listen to those and end up getting drunk and listening to like Is This It or I Get Wet or 12 Golden Country Greats instead. And you know, that's the kind of energy I'm getting from Krangbin. It's a nice sampler of, you know, kind of classy, exotic music. Also, I'm very disappointed to find out that guitarist is wearing a wig.
I'm pretty sure it's a wig. I could be wrong. I don't mean to slander. I don't want to get sued for like hair slander here, but it looks like a wig.
Well, we will, hopefully our Krangbin heads will get to the bottom of this, but they remind me, like, I guess like I reflexively say, yeah, they're lame or whatever, but I don't know if I really believe that. You know, I listen to their music and it sounds fine to me. It's sort of along the lines of Tycho, T-Y-C-H-O, that project that you see headlining just tons of festivals, and you don't really know anyone who loves them, but they're so good at what they do. They really exist at this overlap of a lot of type of people. You know, they do the psych rock thing, they do the jam band thing, they do kind of like world music. I hate to use that term, but like, it's kind of what they are. It's like, if you think that like Tame Impala are like too basic, or that King Gizzard or like Fish are a little too nerdy, Krangbin's the, you know, a band that really suits that need. And I don't think they're clogging a lane. I don't think they're doing anything bad. I don't have enough investment in the kind of music that they play to have too strong of a negative opinion about them. And I definitely, I would not doubt that Pitchfork kicked the tires on them as a headliner this year. But I would say.
And I should say, like, their record, I said it came out this week. It came out last week. It's called A La Sala is the name of the album. Pitchfork was pretty kind to it. They gave it a 7.1. So, you know, and I think that's a proper score for any Krangbin album, because, you know, again, I don't think it's terribly deep music. It's not something that is ever going to define your life. But if you're having a dinner party and you want to put something on that no one will hate, they're perfect for that. Because it's the kind of music that everyone likes, but maybe not a lot of people love. So you need bands like that sometimes. Dinner party music totally works.
Yeah, people have called this, like, there was like this Twitter thread going around about quote-unquote co-worker music. And, you know, I think that's like a very fascinating genre. And I think Krangbin like belongs in there. It's like, you can do a lot worse, but you can do better. And they're just a band that like people dig, you know, like it's really strange, because on one level you want to say, oh, they're kind of like basic and they're not deep. But like the people who like them because of the music. Like there's no other reason. It's not like they're thinking about, you know, like the subtext. In a way, it's like the most pure form of music fandom, which I have to appreciate.
All right, well, let's get to our second letter. This is another yay or nay. It's yay or nay. I was going to say yay or nay Thursday, because we're recording this on Thursday. We should have yay or nay Thursdays once a month. This comes from Mark in Pittsburgh. Real Rust Belt theme here in the
AFC
mailbag.
AFC Central, yeah.
Got Cleveland, Pittsburgh. Love it. Hi, Ian and Steve. Love the show. It's an automatic download every Friday. Thank you, Mark. Ian's recent Huberman tweet. Also, he didn't capitalize Huberman in the email, Mark. Very tricky. It looked like a typo at first. Ian's recent tweet referencing Superman's Dead got me remembering some late 90s Canadian guys. Yay or nay on Our Lady Peace? I feel like this is right in Steve's wheelhouse. I don't know if that's a compliment or not. we'll get to that in a second. I remember watching their videos on Much Music in high school and feeling like they never got the respect they deserved. That's the end of the email. So Mark is in Pittsburgh reading your tweets and just fuming about Our Lady Peace not getting the respect they deserve. Yay or nay on Our Lady Peace, Ian?
Yeah, it's interesting that he said, like, this is right in Steve's wheelhouse, because I'm like, I'm a pretty regular OLP tweeter. I like them in just for the fact that they had their breakthrough album Clumsy and called the next one Happiness ... is not a fish you can catch. Very Zingalama Dooney / Secret Samadhi, like following up your breakthrough with a thunderously dumb album title. I like the fact they made like a dumbed down Radiohead album called Spiritual Machines. And I saw them perform that live in Charlottesville, Virginia. So what I love about Our Lady Peace is that they really hit that sweet spot between being nowhere near as artsy and smart as they think they are, but they're definitely smarter than the average alt-rock time filler. So you get this band who's like kind of ambitious in a way that they can't wrap their arms around. But look, I can't say I've heard an entire album of theirs, but even when I lived with a person in my first year of dorm room who played Clumsy on repeat. But look, Superman's Dead, Clumsy, One Man Army, Mafia, right behind you. Parenthetical, it's the one with Matt Cameron on the drums. Is Anybody Home? 4 a.m. This band has fucking bangers, but the thing that like I'd be interested in exploring in greater depth, I feel this is kind of like basic in terms of like Canuck core, if you want to call it. I mean, we got to talk Matthew Good Band, Big Wreck, I Mother Earth, Econoline Crush. Like, maybe we can like delve in deeper. Maybe this is just something for the Patreon, though. That's a big yay for me, by the way.
You know, sometimes I'm on the show and I forget that I'm hosting it because I just get wrapped up in hearing you talk about some band I know nothing about or don't give a shit about. And I'm just glued to what you're saying because it's fascinating to me, even though I have no idea what the hell you're talking about. Mark, I'm going to disappoint you here. I'm neither yay or nay in this band. I have to push because I don't know one Our Lady Peace song. I listened to them for a little bit in preparation for this episode. I think that's the first time I ever knowingly listened to Our Lady Peace. And I have to say, like, I think that this reveals a very small generation gap between you and me, Ian. I'm like a little bit older than you. And like when this band was hitting, I was in college. This is like late 90s. And I really wasn't listening to like a lot of radio rock at that time. You know, I was listening to like indie rock, essentially. So this micro generation of bands that were making just like rock radio gruel, you know, just pumping it out, I'm not as knowledgeable about it. And I'd probably be more knowledgeable about the bands that came a little bit after this or the ones that came a little bit before. Like, I can talk for a long time about Sponge, but because they're a little bit earlier. That's like more mid-90s.
Yeah.
But like late 90s, I don't know. I feel like this reveals a blind spot for me. So yeah, that whole riff you went on there, you could have been making up song titles and I'd just be nodding my head along because I have no idea. So I have to say push. I am Our Lady Peace ignorant.
What a revelatory, that was so revelatory. I think we need to like explore further like the difference between 1998 alt-rock, which was my first year of college and like the peak of Winamp downloading and like 1996 or 2001. I love the micro generation gaps that appear between myself and like other writers.
Yeah, because there's like this band and like Days of the New.
Oh yeah.
I'd also put in that category. I'm trying to think of like other
better than again, Ezra is probably they're like I think they're your era, right?
Well, the thing is, like, I worked at my college paper and we would listen to the Top 40 station. So like I know a lot of those bands. Like I'm up on Matchbox 20. I'm up on Better Than Ezra because they were more on Top 40 radio than rock radio. You know, I know like Third Eye Blind, like those bands I know, but like there's the Top 40 rock bands and then there's like the rock radio rock bands. And I think Our Lady Peace is more of like the rock radio side. Marcy Playground, like I know, yes, that band, they're on the Top 40 side. So like that's my late 90s radio rock. So yeah, it's not even radio rock. It's like, I know radio rock, but I know Top 40 radio rock. I don't know rock radio rock. So yeah, this is a very minute distinction, but it's important.
Yeah, I guarantee like our listeners would love for us to talk about this like granular difference for hours. I'm like not, that's like not me being sarcastic. I know.
I know, me neither.
I would love it.
And I think I'm realizing this as we're talking about it. I had not thought about it until we like we're literally on the mic here talking about it. But yeah, I think that is a very real distinction. And there is this generation of late 90s rock radio rock bands that maybe are a little under discussed, you know, because the top 40 rock bands, and you could put Smash Mouth in there too, Sugar Ray, stuff like that. That's also in that camp. I know that stuff pretty well, but the other stuff I don't know as well. And I think this might need some further scholarly exploration by us on this podcast. So are we plotting a themed episode at some point in the future? Yeah.
We're going to get a lot of really awesome mailbag questions out of this by people who are like asking like whether the Toadies fall into like one of those two categories. Or
they kind of bridge the worlds, I feel like.
Yes. Or semi. Well, we've had a semi-sonic one before, but I think they're better top than 40. Yeah.
Yeah. Better than semi-sonic is definitely top 40 rock.
Verve Pipe, you know, Seven Mary 3.
They bridge the world. Yeah, they bridge. Well, Cumbersome is top 40, but then I guess there's probably other Seven Mary 3 songs.
River, I don't know. Water's Edge. Yeah, and I believe me, I am not. I do not have the Seven Mary 3 Wikipedia open. This is just off the dome stuff. Like this is how you're getting the good material. I love how Our Lady Peace has just dressed up like so much more of like a compelling narrative than Coachella. This is pure IndieCast.
We've now reached the part of our episode that we call Recommendation Corner, where Ian and I talk about something that we're into this week. Ian, why don't you go first?
All right, so I know this is very much, for lack of a better term, Cohen Core, but let's talk about a Detroit Screamo band with seven members. I just love when the Screamo song is less than 2 minutes long, and it's kind of like blurry, and it's, you know, it's not like they have like glockenspiel and things like that, but it's seven members, and so this is a band called Heavenly Blue. They have a new album out today called We Have the Answer, released on the always reliable Secret Voice label run by Jeremy Bohm of Touche Amore. There's a lot of heavy music this year, you know, whether it's Screamo or like kind of artsy metal hasn't really hit for me. You know, even with the critically acclaimed stuff, sometimes it can kind of all blend together. This one did stand out to me, maybe because it does sound like, you know, seven people have made it. Otherwise, it might be because like the songs are shorter and more punchy. But there's an ambition here that really is pleasing to me. And you can see them kind of going on. If you liked Frail Body, another great record I don't think I got to talk about, or Infant Island. Yeah, there's a lot of like cool bands like doing kind of more ambitious screamo this year. And this is maybe my favorite of the bunch. So Heavenly Blue, We Have the Answer.
All right. So before I do my recommendation this week, I looked at Twitter while you were talking about your recommendation. And I wanted to be the person to tell you this. O.J. Simpson died.
Yeah, I want to do kind of the Our Lady Peace, instead of Huberman's dead, that tweet, I'll do like O.J. Simpson's dead in the Our Lady Peace voice. You know,
so
how
you just went immediately to the tweet. Like, what am I going to tweet? I tell you this news. I was expecting more of a reaction. You're just going right into
That's because I know he's dead. I saw.
Oh, you knew?
I got an Apple.
I was hoping I could surprise you that he died.
Apple News had a alert that popped up on my phone in the middle.
Okay. And you were able to still perform on the show even though you knew O.J. Simpson died? That's the amount of focus you have for IndieCast? That's very impressive. Didn't throw you for a loop. I want to recommend a documentary that is coming out today in theaters as well as on video on demand. So Amazon, Apple, wherever you rent films. It's called Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill. And I just got the screener for this last night. So I haven't actually been able to finish this movie yet. I've seen a good chunk of it, and it's really great so far. So I feel good about recommending it. Judy Sill is just a fascinating cult hero in folk rock circles. She's a singer-songwriter, put out some records in the 70s. And in terms of her contemporary relevance, she's a big influence on people like Big Thief, Fleet Foxes, Wise Blood, a lot of, you could say, folky acts, singer-songwriter acts. They all revere Judy Sill. And along with her music just being fantastic, she has like an incredible backstory. You know, before she was famous, she was living in her car. She was working as a sex worker. She was addicted to heroin, just living a real down and out life. And 2 years later, she was on the cover of Rolling Stone. Just an amazing trajectory. But then just as quickly as she rose to fame, she really fell back into a very destructive lifestyle, and she ended up passing away in 1979. Her death was ruled a suicide, but there's some doubt as to whether her drug overdose was intentional or not. So along with just having a great musical history that is, the people that know her revere her, but she's still not super well known. You have that going on. And then again, you just have like one of the more fascinating musician backstories, like, of anyone you're going to see. So this movie, I definitely recommend it. If you're a fan, it pays proper tribute to her. If you're unfamiliar, again, I think the story is so compelling that you're going to want to get sucked in, and you'll probably end up being a fan. So Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill, it's in theaters now, or you can watch it at home on video on demand. That about does it for this episode of IndieCast. We'll be back with more news, reviews, and hashing out trends next week.
And if you're looking for more music recommendations, sign up for the Indie Mixtape newsletter. You can go to uprocks.com/indie, and I recommend 5 albums per week, and we'll send it directly to your email box.